Blog Talk.
Blog Talk Radio, hosted by Kareem Ali of the NCWCC, National Coalition of Women of Color Talk Forum. And we are live from Stone Mountain, Georgia. And we would like to share the topic for today. It's called Inspiring Success, Creating Opportunities, and Building Sustainable Networks. With attorneys and funding sources and other resources, we have a large amount of guests that are going to be on the show today. We have callers that are calling in. I'd like to go over a couple of statistics that's a part of the Center for Women Research Business for Women of Color. Some of the obstacles that have been sustained or been obstacles for business owners are what we have learned, and we're not surprised about, is that many of business obstacles that participants discussed are the same issues that all women business owners and perhaps small business owners face. The four major obstacles that women identified facing them and their businesses were human resources, cash flow and capital, marketing, scope, and consumer relationships, access to decision makers, networking, and strategic partnership. For example, in 2002, Asian women represented 5.3% of women business owners, and the census reported the average annual earnings were $158,000. However, black women represented 8.4% of women business owners, yet the average annual earnings were no more lower than roughly $38,000. We have interest in talking with individuals from different organizations And for the show today, we're going to have a dynamic individual that I met through SCORE, an SBA program. Her name is Karen, and she owns Launch Funding Network, and she has agreed to partner up with the coalition to provide capital for the needs of our businesses. So we want to she should be on shortly. We also have another guest that's going to be on with us, Diana Watley. She has a young women's program that is geared in terms of the young women ages 12 to 21, and she's currently working with on the collegiate level of mentoring with Spelman College. And we are going to be moving further into the show with a different variety of callers, but we welcome callers from 219.
Hello. Yes.
Welcome to the show, ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay. Caller from 651. Welcome, caller.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And caller from 770.
That could be me, Karen Rand.
Okay, Karen. How are you doing?
Good.
Okay. Appreciate you coming on the show. And I know you guys have a strong schedule because of the holidays that's coming up, but I had a wonderful time listening to you yesterday at the SCORE workshop with SBA, and we have some callers on that are part of the executive board as well, and we trust in the fact that your knowledge and us possibly getting together on a lot of business ventures for our members and partners would be someplace that we really need to go. So could you give us an idea about your company history and the services that you all provide?
Who would you like to start?
Karen, you.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, great. I'm delighted to be on your show. It was fun being on the panel last night and talking with you earlier today. we work with companies of various different stages to help them understand what type of capital is available for them to grow their business. And we do that through an initial registration call. And then we also, to sort of understand their business, they fill out a short form, and we'll do a review with them about what they're trying to accomplish and help them make some decisions that way on what's available to them. And then we take them through a business plan review process if they have a business plan, to make sure that it meets the needs of the type of funding that they're going for, whether it's alternative financing or traditional loan or private investors might invest in their business, or venture capital or some other type of institutional funding.
Okay.
And we do that through the Launch Funding Network website, which is launchfn.com, LAUNCHF as in funding, N as in network.com.
Okay. And interesting enough, of what I heard you on yesterday, I took quite a bit of notes, this angel investments that we were talking about in the market participant level of marketing, that the product in which you are similar, I guess, in business. Those angel investors, they look for different types of individuals and different kind of models, and they can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Angel investors come in lots of different flavors. And for those that aren't familiar with that, necessarily the term for an angel investor, basically it's a it's really anybody that has the liquid capital that is available to put at risk with a company in an expectation that they're going to either share in the revenues of that company or be able to, as a silent partner perhaps, or they're going to take a piece of that company, an equity stake in that company, and then share in the outcome when that company builds themselves up big enough to sell the company or have some other form of a liquidity event. So when you have a company that is in that may be what some might consider a lifestyle business, or it's what we call a market participant. There's a lot of other kind of companies that are like them out there in the marketplace. You know, they still have the ability to go out to individuals to get them to participate, but it's going to be for a different reason than it will be for somebody that what we would consider an objective investor, a business investor, somebody that's in the business of investing. Those are folks that would have $1 million or $2 million in net worth, have around $300,000 to $400,000 in annual income. And those folks, you know, take a piece of their portfolio or the piece of their liquid capital and put that, you know, maybe 10% of their available capital and put that into early stage companies with the idea that that company is going to grow significantly, go from, you know, being pre-revenue to a $5 or $10 or $20 million company in a few years, so they get a substantial return on their investment because they're providing the most risky investment that's out there. And the way a entrepreneur would approach these folks, if they're of that first type, they're going to approach them, or if they're in what we would consider a seed stage or a startup stage, then they're going to approach people that they know and let them know about their business opportunity. And based on either that person is someone that could invest, that's where you hear the term friends and family, or it's somebody that they know, they want to help that entrepreneur be successful, so they'll help them set up cups of coffee or have, you know, a meeting to introduce them to somebody that they know might be a potential investor. And oftentimes, you know, they don't have those kind of conversations, so you look for indicators of somebody that might be a potential investor that you can connect to through somebody that you know, and that's somebody that may have sold a company recently or somebody that has taken some kind of a retirement package from a company, so they've received some chunk of cash. And they are looking to put that to work as a silent partner. They might be thinking about buying a franchise, but instead, because they're presented with this opportunity and the entrepreneur has the credibility and the work ethic and they trust that entrepreneur is going to man the shop well, then they'll become a silent partner in that entrepreneur's endeavor rather than participating or buying a franchise. And they get to share. They might have an earn-out over time, so they receive their money back as if it was a loan, and then they own a minor share in the company going forward. So that's how oftentimes folks that are in just, you know, regular businesses that they're running that might be considered, you know, small businesses with less than, you know, $500,000 or $1 million in revenue, and they don't have a huge growth potential, they can attract capital sources from non-bank investors, you know, non-bank sources of funds that way. And when they get past that stage and they're looking for to get investments of, you know, $1 million or more, then they're getting into the realm of those investors that are those business investors. And the thing you have to remember about a business investor, or somebody that we call an objective investor, is that they have lots of options for what they spend their money on, and they typically have a lifestyle that they are not, you know, going to work every day, and so they're sometimes hard to nail down, so to speak. They, you know, will express interest in a deal, and then they'll go on a trip, or they'll have some family thing going, or they'll decide to go winter in, you know, Florida or something like that. And it's not that they aren't interested in the project; it's that they just are. There, nothing bad happens as far as they're concerned if they don't invest. And because you have to think about from an entrepreneur's perspective, they're always. You know, every entrepreneur thinks their deal is the best deal, right? And they're always pushing that this one's going to make a big return, it's going to be a real big company. So from an investor's perspective, if they believe that, there's always another good deal coming down the road. So the real trick for if you're pursuing those kinds of investors is to stay in touch with them. Don't be discouraged when they don't talk to you for a while because they're grown men and women and they can say no. And if they don't say no, it's not a no. So just like you approach a customer will, love a product, but for some reason doesn't make a buying decision. You got to figure out why they're not making a buying decision. Could be, you know, it's not in the budget for this particular quarter, or it could be that, you know, the point of pain's not that at that point yet. But you don't give up on that customer because they haven't said no. So that's the same way with investors. You don't want to be pushy. You just want to keep them informed of the progress of the company. So when they are ready to make an investment decision, they choose your company instead of another company they just saw, you know, 2 days before.
And so that, so we basically saying we have to learn how to raise seed money. So we have like a round for pre-revenue when you start into if you're a startup or you're an entrepreneur looking for a business investor. So that's the, because that's what I got in understanding, that you have to learn how to say, okay, I'm going to talk to, 300 people, and so you won't be discouraged about that only 30 people you talk to. You need to talk to as many people as possible, right? I think that was one of the
right. I call that the Cougaran theory of private equity. Cougaran Holdings is the company I own that owns my angel investor group, the Network of Business Angels and Investors, as also the consulting services group, Launch Funding Network, that I've already talked about. And then we have a media company, KBR Media, that offers books and resources for entrepreneurs and investors. And so I've, over time, I named it the Cougaran theory of private equity because nobody really would care if it was Karen Rand's theory of private equity. So not yet, at least. So I named it the Cougaran theory of private equity because that sounds important, kind of like Moore's Law, you know.
Right.
Anyway, so that theory says for every check writer you have, and this has been proven out from just I've been working with entrepreneurs and investors for about 5 years now, I guess, maybe more. For every check writer, you'll have three that you think will write a check because they'll say all kinds of things like, oh, that sounds good, give me the stuff, and you know, or I'm going to know somebody that's going to be really interested, let me talk to my partner about it, okay?
Right.
And then for those three that you think will write a check, you'll have to have talked to 15 to have to get to that point, and that means that they've, you know, made a conscious decision, looked at some piece of information and said, no, not for me, or yeah, send me some information. We met them at an event, and you talk to them about it. But they have a conscious decision of saying no or yes on getting to the next step, which is, you know, reviewing the business plan and deciding to sit down and have a meeting. And so, when you think about a funnel, like a sales funnel, you know, if you're trying to raise $1 million and in $50,000 increments, then that's 20 check writers. And to get to the 20 check writers, you'll have 60 that you thought were going to say yes at some point in time because it could take you a year. The government says take a year to raise $1 million, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they know, even the government knows it's going to take probably a year to raise $1 million. So, you know, the 60 check writers actually equates to 300 people have to have looked at it at some point in time. And that's a daunting number because most entrepreneurs don't really, they can think of about seeing 60 people, but they never really think through the whole process of trying to get it in front of 300 people. But when they do the heavy lifting and they learn, and every time you give a presentation, you get better at it. Just like every time you give a sales presentation, you get better at it. So, you know, you may close somebody early on when you're doing a sales presentation out of luck, but then you get really good and your close rate goes up as you get further down. And so when a company's doing that, you know, they first start out, they kind of, it's a learned art, and then they learn how to say the right things and ask the right questions and you know, qualify and push through the process as they get better and better at it. And so as they get better and better at raising capital, and they get better at converting those maybes into yeses, and so you get a momentum going once you get going that will happen if you stick to it and you understand that you have to have a pipeline of investors that you're working with.
So there's a traditional way of getting capital, which is going through the SBA and things of that nature. And this is the more innovative way of raising capital when it comes down to the different ideals that we've been talking with you about. The you said something about the secret sauce is a referral of somebody to get into me, be warm and fuzzy about working with you and selling yourself. I think you mentioned yesterday that you have to believe and trust in yourself and in your business and be confident. So at 60 people, right, you might want to, you know, convince another 230 folks. And so it takes a lot of, you have to have a lot of, faith in yourself when you go in this line of pursuing capital, right?
Oh, sure. See, that's one of the things that people don't ever really talk about or think about because, you know, we talk with these entrepreneurs all the time and they're, you know, and I tell them that they need to go out to their friends and family or see they come to us and they've maybe put $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 of their own money into getting their business to, you know, sort of beyond startup stage. And they want to go raise a couple $1 million. Well, that's almost really too much money unless it's a real high-tech kind of a thing to raise based off the, sort of the balance of the scales are tipped because mm-hmm. they're raising significant amount of money compared to what they've put into it. And so when they look at the valuation of the company and how much the investors see that they put at risk, the investors are – they don't want to be the first money in. So they expect that the company to have gone out and raised, when you get to these objective investors, that you're going to go out and raise – a few $100,000 from people that you know. And the reason why they do that, sort of the little checklist that nobody talks about in the back of their heads, they're saying, if this person, you know, particularly if they're somebody that's been in the workforce for, you know, a couple of decades, then, you know, they've worked for people, worked with people, they, you know, in most time graduated from college, they've been a part of professional organizations. They've, you know, developed just general friendships over time. They have, you know, they have an alumni association that they're working with, and those people have various levels of success. So they, you know, they say that the average person knows 200 or 300 or 400 people. They just don't really think about it. You know, if you have to think about how many cards you send out when you actually used to do Christmas cards, when you send out Christmas cards, you send out a bunch of Christmas cards. People know a lot of people. And they just, and so to an investor, what they're looking at is of all the people that that person knows, they can't find five people that will give them $20,000 a piece. And if they can't find that, then it's either one of two reasons. They either lack the guts to go and ask those folks, and that means that they lack the guts to actually build a big multi-million-dollar business, or those people know something about that entrepreneur that makes them too risky of an investment for them to put their money at risk when they know them. Then why would I put my money at risk when I don't know them? And so it's a litmus test to the investors that you have the ability to go and put some money into, you have the ability to raise some money before you go out and get really kind of proof of the pudding done before you go out to the objective investors that just met you that day.
And then there's the other part where those individuals are personal individuals that have their own resources, personal resources, but the venture capital firms is also one of the primary levels that that you mentioned yesterday as well. You can approach those types of firms as well, right?
Sure. Now, you know, it's a food chain, okay? So you start out with angel investors because they're putting their own money in, and you sort of understand the food chain. The average investment that an individual angel investor will do is really between $25,000 and $50,000. When it comes time for them to write a $100,000 check, it's because either they're extremely high net worth or they just really have gotten to the point that they're comfortable with that company because they may be investing $200,000 this year in private equity, but they're not going to put it in just two companies. They're going to put it in four companies, so they spread their risk around, right?
Right.
So they're not going to put it all their eggs in one basket in one company. So, you know, that's the reason why that average, you know, people of that kind of net worth are more likely – you know, you think about it, if they spend $35,000 on a country club membership or they, you know, go on a cruise that costs them $20,000, you know, that's the kind of thing. They have the liquid capital to be able to do that just because, oh, this sounds good, right? It's almost like going to Vegas and gambling, right? This sounds good. This is worth something. You know, if it hits, great. If it doesn't, you know, it's kind of fun being a part of it. It's good, you know, barbecue talk or cocktail talk or something, you know?
Okay.
And so but the thing about angel investors, as I said earlier, nothing bad happens if they don't invest. They're investing their own money. So if you think about the largest check you've ever written and how you felt about writing that check at that time and your comfort level in doing that and how certain you were, whatever it was that you were going to be, you know, purchasing or whatever at the time, you know, you wanted to be very, very comfortable. Well, it's similar to them. They want to be pretty comfortable about what's going on. Now, when you move up the food chain to the venture capital firms are firms that have you know, probably at a minimum $50 million. Even the little boutique guys that kind of talk like angels and act like angels but operate like a venture capital firm, they still have $30 million or so, you know, access to them. And so in that case, when what they've done is they've pooled other people's money. So the Bernie Marcuses of the world rarely ever write an individual check. They'll put $2 million into a venture capital fund and let the venture capital fund write the checks, okay? So they, you know, or big family trusts, they invest in these venture capital funds. And so the venture capital firm has an obligation to make that investment over some period of time. And so they have a management fee that they're paid to look at deals and make decisions on deals. So they are going to make decisions in a much more timely fashion than an angel investor is going to make it, at least to be able to say yes or no in a much more timely fashion. And they're going to tend to write much bigger checks. But the nature of that is they're writing a $1 million check or a $2 million check because they have a $50 million fund. You know, they don't want to have 100 companies that they're managing. They're invested in. They want to have maybe 20 or 30. So depending on how big their fund is how big of the investments that they make. And so if they're going to make a $2 or $3 or $4 million investment, that's because the company is at a $10, $15, $20 million valuation. They've got $2, $3, $4, $5 million in revenue already. And when they go to put that money in. And so you're much further up the food chain. You really have already done an angel round by the time you get to doing the VC round. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, VCs are, by the very nature of the size of what they're working with, they have to work with companies that are further along. And, you know, where they are in that space, it varies after the dot-com period. They went way up the food chain, and they weren't doing any early stage. And then as they got more money and they had to put it to work, they started going further down the food chain and started bumping up to, you know, one of our local firms here, Norrell Mosley. I never would have thought that they would invest in kind of the stages that the companies that we look at because mm-hmm. of what they said. But then when I come to find that they're talking to certain companies that we're talking to too, I'm thinking, well, they've gone down the food chain. You know, they want to make sure that there's really significant amount of quality management team. There's a really proven business model. There's definitely revenues already coming in and a strong pipeline. And they'll still consider that fairly early stage because you think about it, if a company's doing $2 million in revenue and if they're expected to be for a VC kind of funded company, they're expected to be $50 million in 5 years or 6 years or something like that. So, you know, that is early, very early stage for a $50 million company.
But venture capital people, they are more hungrier for their return. So a lot of people who are listening right now, they may be one of the best outs as you go up the food chain, but they are expecting, and so like you were saying, if you go public, you know, a dollar with your stock, you know, your stock might be a dollar, and then, you know, it turns out to be $5 2 years or 3 years down the line. They want a chunk of their money back. So you're really exposing your company to sharing almost, what, percentage of 30 or 40% of your business revenues after a while when they're part of your company?
Well, you really don't share your revenues like that unless you're an LLC, you might, but then you can set up your operating agreement so you don't have to disperse that out to all of the you can, you know, reinvest it like you would with a C Corp or something. Mm-hmm. So they're really looking to be a share owner. And they may get dividends, but they want you to reinvest your money into the company and keep the company growing. And so they're really looking for the liquidity event. So if they buy a share at $2 a share, for example, and then they build it up and they go public at $10 a share, or they get bought at, you know, $8 a share, and they made four times their money or something. So the thing you have to understand when you get into the VC world, they also draft a lot of terms, and they sometimes get first right of refusal on whatever the exit strategy is. So an entrepreneur may be thinking, I'm ready to sell this company. I just got this offer. I'm going to make, you know, millions of dollars if I can sell it to these guys. And the VCs guys are going, no, I think we should grow it some more, right, or something like that, you know. And So it's, you know, you have to be really, really careful when it comes to, and even at the early stage, one of the companies that was there at the SBA thing last night came over and talked to me and asked me if I knew anybody that bought out angels. Or did they do that because, you know, they, when they originally made their structure of their deal, mm-hmm. they didn't really think that that was going to be something, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road that you'd have angels that want to go ahead and exit out. And so they're trying to find, do I go take out a big loan to buy them out? How do I go take them out? I don't really want to go take in additional money to buy them out. You know, how do I do that? So, you know, you got to make sure that, you know, whoever you go to the party with is somebody you want to stay at the party with.
Most of entrepreneurs, the shortfalls and when they're trying to like this day and age, I mean, we're really in a financial bind in some levels, and I think we talked about that earlier with the way the banks, you know, but with the FDIC, when folks were telling folks that, you know, you need to move, you know, if you got $200,000 in the bank, you need to move $100,000 because FDIC is not, you know, guaranteeing. So basically, is the industry so in a level that the landscape is really bad out there in terms of being I've been able to identify the funding levels in order for folks to, you know, get capital? Because that is really one of the everybody's looking for some form of capital, and the banks are, you know, are not giving money out right now. And so what are the other what's the landscape out there in terms of that?
Well, you know, I think all investors are a little bit more cautious right now just because nobody really knows what's going to happen in the next, you know, 3 to 4 or 5 months. So, you know, the thing we've seen the most happen within the angel investor space, we've seen two things happen. If you got a group of angels that are part of a formal group that really invest together, and there's a number of those that are around, a great resource to find those types of angel groups are through the Angel Capital Association, or you go to the Angel Soft. It's not angelsoft.com because that's something else, but it's the Angel Soft software is a software program that most of these angel groups use. And they'll come together as a group and make an investment, but they really, because of that power of being able to bring, you know, $500,000 to the table, they'll mm-hmm. negotiate terms, and most often what we see happening is that they're really pushing down the valuation of the company so they get more for their money. And that's been because money's tight, and so entrepreneurs are taking it, right?
Right.
They don't think they can get it. They don't know. They, hey, at least, you know, a bird in the hand is better than
two in a bush.
Whatever.
That's what my mom says.
So that's kind of what we're seeing from on, you know, sort of something that I see happening in that space. Although we have seen quite a few investors come back into the game that weren't active in the summertime, or, you know, we did a private equity conference, the Southeast Private Equity Conference in April. We'll be doing it again this next April in here in Atlanta. Information on that is at seprivateequity.org for southeastprivateequity.org. And we were really worried back when we did it in April because if you remember back in February and March, there was a whole bunch of stuff going on at that time. And everybody was all very nervous, you know.
Right.
And we were really worried that we weren't going to have anybody come out to our – and we did, you know, because we – you know, it was not a cheap event. And so we had plenty of people. We had 180 folks there, you know. So we were really worried at that time. We were encouraged that there was all those folks. And I think what happened a lot back then was that some of these really – these very savvy investors and people that are angel investors are very savvy because – there, if you've ever read any of Robert Kiyosaki's information, particularly Cash Flow Quadrant or
yep.
Rich Dad's Guide to Investing, you know, he talks about people, you know, having strong financial IQs and kind of really charting their own course when it comes to where they're going to put their money and have lots of different assets, private equity being one of those. And so we believe that some of those folks took their money out of the market or started moving it into fixed income or into, you know, things that were a little bit more guaranteed because the market wasn't, you know, really great at that time either. And so now what we've seen with this market continue to be, you know, fluctuating, and then the real decline we've had in the last, you know, few weeks is that they're looking at, you know, well, shoot, if I'm going to make 3.5% on my money, I'm not doing that for the next 2 years. You know, I might as well go put some in private equity.
Right.
So they've got a lot of, again, though, they have options. So they can go cherry pick some of these great stocks that are beaten down when they really don't necessarily need to be beaten down or definitely not that low of a value. And they'll put some into the stock market. There's a lot of great real estate opportunities out there. So they'll go ahead and put some in real estate. But they're getting back into private equity because what has been shown here in the last 6 months definitely is that all asset classes are risky. There is no, even the stock market is not a guarantee anymore. Real estate's not a guarantee anymore. And so private equity, which has always been considered the most risky investment asset
better
classes,
now, don't it?
Because you get the biggest return on your investment. It's the only one that you have potential to make 10 times your money. When I was at the Venture Atlanta conference in a few weeks back, it was early part of October, or maybe it was early part of November, I forget now. I think anyway, they at that particular event, Bernie Marcus was the keynote speaker. And somebody asked him, because there's a lot of venture capital folks there, what would a $1,000 investment in his company back when he was at that angel round be worth? And he said, well, if they had held their stock and when it went through all the splits and all that kind of stuff, it'd be worth $70 million today. And so that's a phenomenal return on investment. You know?
Okay.
So, you know, that's usually like, you know, everybody always says, well, if I'd known Home Depot would have been as big as it was, I would have invested too, right? Well, you know, nobody knows. And that's the reason why they diversify, because they don't know which one's going to be that pet puppet on, you know, during the Super Bowl commercials that everybody's talking about, or they're going to be the Home Depots of the world, right? I mean, you just don't know. And so there's so many factors that affect that. And but what I always tell folks is that even the investors, the angel investors that invested in Webvan, they all made their money. It was the ones that invested when the stock was at $15 a share, you know, and then you know it dropped after that, and they lost all their money. I heard a story yesterday that I guess I have to go look this up and see where the source was, but somebody had seen an article or an interview or something like that. When Google was first getting started, they paid this lady to come in and do massages for them. You know, because they were all working 24 hours a day, you know, kind of a thing when they were kind of getting going. And they paid her shares, okay? They didn't have any money. They paid her shares, you know, in the early days. And she went through when it went public, and she sold it when it got to, like, $7 a share.
Okay.
And she made $7 million. She didn't even put any money in. She just, you know, had some really good hand muscles, you know? I mean, so it's like, you know, private equity, if you can invest in a company when it's really early stage, you know, and guess what? You know, the founders, I mean, in those kind of scenarios, you know, people go, oh, wow, that investor made, well, that investor put that money at risk. But those, I mean, the reason why Bernie Marcus can build an aquarium is because, you know, he had a huge chunk of that share, that those shares that he was building it as a founder. And, you know, they own less than 10% of Home Depot now, right?
So
but he's got tons of money to be out there doing, you know, have this autism foundation, to have, you know, do the aquarium, to do all the things that he does, right?
Uh-huh. And this is what I have a cash flow quadrant, and I was looking at capitalists and what they really do, and I think he is a capitalist because it says that they create, they provide money that creates jobs, the businesses, and the goods that make the country prosper. So maybe that is where we should be at in terms of working with venture capital people, because that we have a caller from 678-732.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing, Diane?
Hey, how are you?
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm glad. I saw you jumping back off on the switchboard here.
Yeah.
We have our first guest on, and I think it's very important that you kind of listen in on what they do in terms of private equity and angel investors. I think this would be a tremendous situation to kind of learn about. But what I was saying was that they talk about level six at the cash flow quadrant on capitalists. It's a few people in the world reach this level of investment excellence. In America, less than one person in 100 is a true capitalist. this person is usually an excellent B as well as an excellent I, because he or she can create businesses and investment opportunities simultaneously. So I understand completely, just understanding the rich dad poor dad cash flow quadrant. Understanding that, and I think that is one of the things as business owners and entrepreneurs that we need to identify how to raise money. You had my attention yesterday when you said entrepreneurs need to know how to raise money, and so therefore, when you learn how to raise money on a different level, then you become more successful in building sustainability for your company. And people are a champion of people who are confident in themselves. I believe that's the most important thing. We also had another situation that we were talking about, which I thought was really interesting, as we were talking about the banks today, about how they're not, you know, they're because they're afraid. That's why everything is still kind of people can't go to the bank and get loans, because they're still afraid. And when they're afraid of lending money that they already have, you know, I think you told me the Federal Reserve has more money than it's ever had in, since, what, 1931 or so I just thought that was interesting, that that we don't understand as entrepreneurs. There's so many different ways of finding capital for our projects, for our visions, for our dreams, and we have to be able to obtain people like yourself, firms like yours, so that the women will be able to launch different types of funding campaigns, I believe. The one thing that I wanted to ask was, when you talk about this angel investors, do angel investors invest into nonprofits?
Well, there's a type of sort of an investment philosophy called double bottom line. And double bottom line is when there's some kind of economic good that's being done, or social good being done, as well as the company's making money.
Mm-hmm.
Investors, it's a sort of an oxymoron. They're not investing in a nonprofit, because most often nonprofits don't disperse profits, or they don't get bought. So it's really not an investment. It's a donation. You know, so it's they do that, but they do that because it's the same sort of people that would invest in a regular for-profit company. But they do that because there's, they just believe in it, and they're willing to take the tax write-off on it. You know, that's really kind of the bottom line on that. We had a company that approached us for our next event next week. We do an angel investor event. Next year we'll be doing them the second Wednesday of every month. And that wanted to come, and he was a nonprofit for literacy. And I said, no, really what you need to do is sponsor, because you're not really doing an investor pitch, but you can have 10 minutes up there to talk to these investors to see if you can get them to want to, you know, participate in building your nonprofit up, because they just believe in it, right? And they want to be a part of that, and they have the means to do it. So, you know, it's sort of a different, kind of a different approach, because, you know, I've never really known if it's to sort of sell for. Now, sometimes you'll have a for-profit company that has a non-profit element,
mm-hmm.
and so you invest in the for-profit company, that a portion of their proceeds or something goes to the non-profit, and that could end up being a way that a company might structure that if they had that double bottom line kind of an approach.
Well, that's our approach as a coalition. We have a for-profit with a non-profit look in the end, bottom line, but the part that I was concerned about is, because the young lady that just came on has a program that she runs. Diane?
I'm here.
Okay. Can you tell everybody about your program real quickly, so we can might be able to advise you on some things?
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for joining us, and thank you to Ms. Ali. My name is Diana Watley, and I'm the CEO and founder of Skilling Issues, INC, and it's a both actually listening to the conversation, I do have a profit corporation set up, as well as attempting to get a nonprofit organization. But it was established to reach young women who would not otherwise have an opportunity to receive basic training and positive lifestyles. And so through my program called Pillow Talk, under the umbrella of Feminist Shoes INC, I go around the city of Atlanta where we are based and host mentoring sessions for our young women. And it's just, you know, to give them the basic skills, you know, they may not be afforded to due to single-parent household, a mother working full-time. And so we're acting as a safe haven for these young women in our community and just giving them the skills they need in order to become productive adults and productive women.
That's the nonprofit.
Correct.
And the profit?
The profit is the umbrella where we throw our, say, I might just host an event to put back into the nonprofit, and my motivational CD and the book will come under the umbrella of the profit organization.
And would that fit Karen into where she has a product of services, of that CD? That, what's the name of the CD again?
The first one is I Choose Me, and the second one is called You Don't Live Here Anymore.
And what is I Choose Me?
And I Choose Me is basically a CD to, it's kind of like the introduction for me doing CDs, and it's talking about, you know, choosing yourself and knowing what it is to be a woman, knowing what it is to be respected, knowing your worth. And I feel like that's the basis of knowing everything else, because after you know who you are, what you'll accept, what you won't accept, and then you can go on to dealing with all the other things that are in your life. And the next You Don't Live Here Anymore is basically just honing in on some of the obstacles and the different situations our young women or women in general go through, and not allowing those things to be the basis to the reason why you fail or succeed. Just saying everybody has problems. We all go through different obstacles and different things, but, you know, you don't live here anymore. It's just telling your past pains and your obstacles or people who negatively affected your life to, you know, you're no longer here anymore, and it's time for me to grow and move on.
And so basically it has it's not just a talking CD. It has music and all that to it too as well.
Right, because the approach is, because my demographic is mostly young women from the age of 12 to 21, I know what they listen to. And so my idea about it was to, you know, since they're all into the rap music or different songs and they have the ringtones on their phone and different things that they like, I said, well, let me find a way to creatively put a message into the song they like. And so I take the lyrics or take the beats of songs that they listen to on a daily basis and just add a positive message to it. And so in the back of me talking, I mean, it might be Beyonce singing to the left, but it's just, you know, blending what they normally listen to or what the trend is for now into something more powerful. And so they, you know, they can pop it in on the way to school in the morning, but here they is. They might hear the to the left from Beyonce, but they also hearing, you know, positive message and positive reinforcement.
Okay, thank you for a moment here. Caller from 952, welcome to the call.
Hi, thank you, Karima. How you doing?
Wonderful. Okay, and this is?
Michelle Mills from Minnesota.
Hey, how you doing, Michelle? Wonderful.
Good. Excuse my voice, so I'm fighting a little something here, but yeah, good to be on the line.
Okay, all right. Karen, I wanted to just have that young lady kind of tell you where she was. She was able to talk with us earlier today, and I don't know exactly if you have any kind of way of helping or assisting her or guiding her in any kind of way to provide someone or something to help her fund at least the profit side of her company. What would be some of the things that you could tell her that she could possibly do to structure the profit company for a person that may have a corporate social responsibility heart, kind of, sort of,
yeah.
To position her in that.
Well, you got to get on something like that, on any of those kind of things, you really have to get to a point where you're going after what we call those subjective investors. You know, it's somebody that has a heart for what it is that she's doing. They share her passion for what she's trying to do with the nonprofit. So they're willing to work, try to figure out how do I, you know, put this in from a for-profit or a nonprofit or, you know, whatever. You know, they're a part of that. And if she's, you know, if she gets to a point, I mean, there's a lot of programs in Georgia, and even in every state, Georgia's probably third on the list. But if you get to a point where you're creating videos or you're creating kind of video content, movie content, you're doing educational videos or something like that, well, you can apply for tax credits within the state for getting an offset to whatever expenses you have for equipment, labor, things like that. And then you can sell those tax credits to investors. And then you sell those tax credits, and then you go take that money and do what you need to do, either back into your profit, or you can, you know, they can be an investor and they get the tax credits themselves, or you can just go outright and sell your tax credits. So you say you spend, you know, $100,000, or we probably need more money than that, because it's usually like about 13%. So if you say you spend $100,000 or $200,000, and you got, depending on the types of what it is you spend it on, it's anywhere from 9 to like 13 or 15%. But you know, would pick up, you know, $15,000 or something in tax credits that you could go sell to somebody, and you might be able to sell them at a premium. I know some folks that do those tax, you know, buy and sell those tax credits, and, you know, I think they do sometimes buy them at a premium. But, that's one way to kind of work that circuit, if you will. And the reason why the state of Georgia offered those kind of tax credits is that they're trying to fuel job development. It all comes back to the economy. They're trying to fuel job development and have more people come and do movies here and do games and gaming and these kind of things here. And when they do that, they do the editing, they do the production, they do the filming here, then they're going to give that company the tax credits in order to encourage them to do it here and create jobs here, right? And every state has it. Louisiana right now is like the highest because they've been trying to recover from Katrina. So they have the biggest tax credits, and it varies, you know, by state. You know, other than that, we're like third or fourth on the list. We just really kind of anteed up just some more here lately. So that's one angle of it. The other is just going to be going back to, you know, probably even more so on that friends and family concept, where somebody has an affinity, and it's affinity group. They have a passion for either the product, service you're offering, or the entrepreneur themselves, and they just want to be a part of whatever that company's doing.
Okay. And Diane, are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay. Somebody almost fell off the phone. Yeah, I guess that's what I want everybody to understand, that a lot of us are so traditionally do not understand the different levels. I never knew that you could sell your tax credits. That's something that's new. It's a fundraising scenario too, or a way to raise capital that a lot of us didn't. I know I didn't know anything about that. I'm not sure if the other callers did, but that is why we inspire success by creating opportunities and building sustainable networks with funding and resources. And this is why a lot of us are stagnant in business and in our dreams, because we don't understand how to build those bridges back to each other. Everybody always has a passion, I believe, and everybody has an opportunity to release those passions. But if it doesn't turn, you don't have the capital to manifest that, then you're pretty much like everybody else. Everybody has a bunch of dreams running around here and all this, but when it comes down to the bottom line, that how do we maintain our cash flow, raise capital, provide the resources that we need for our company, you know, cash flow, how do we market that scenario? And that's why I thought it was so important. When I saw Karen, I was going to kidnap her last night and just hold her hostage. I didn't know if I'd be able to get her on the phone today. And I really appreciate you jumping aboard and moving forward with us. I'm hoping that people like Diane and her network of individuals that she deal with will be able to call you back. And can you give us your website again before you?
Sure. I have a couple of websites. There's the main one for companies to come to that are entrepreneurs seeking guidance in, you know, how to go about finding different types of capital is launchfundingnetwork.com, launchfundingnetwork.com, or launchfn.com. And then our angel investor group is the Network of Business Angels and Investors, and that's nbai.net. And I want to encourage people to go get a lot of free information that we have. If you go to the launchfn.com site, if you click on info and links, it has links to all of these other sites, but we run two blogs. One is the Entrepreneur Blog Space, and that has a lot of content, different entries that I've put in there, and I tend to write a lot, so I don't, they're not short blogs, but when they're, and all of my, I have a radio show also on Blog Talk Radio on Fridays at noon. It's a blog, it's called Spec Talk Radio, it's Southeast Private Equity Community, and it's, the link is blogtalkradio.com/Karen-Rands, and we have entrepreneurs come on there that talk about their success stories, or various service providers come on and talk about how they can help, how they companies can succeed using different types of methodologies, or how investors can, you know, do more to be participate in the angel investor community, and so all of those podcasts and all those recordings, you can go there and hear them, but they're also put on the blog sites and on my podcast site, which is cougarand.podomatic.com. So lots of content out there to for folks to – there's one, too, that you might want to check out that's called getinvestormoney.com, and that's a series of emails that sort of tips and techniques on how to talk to investors and meet with investors and go about raising capital.
You have an event that's coming up next week, December 3rd, right, at the Ravenna
Club? I sure do.
Okay.
That's right. Anybody, service providers or entrepreneurs out there that want to come and network with investors, service providers that work with their early stage companies, other entrepreneurs, we are, after our investor event, we're opening it up to a general networking. Normally, it's just the investors and the companies that are presenting at it, but we're going to open it up as a capital community celebration, and that's from 5 to 7:30 or so. At the Ravenna Club, it's $25 if you sign up in advance for any companies that are in the Atlanta area.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have an opportunity for tables right now for people that want to sort of promote their business to other entrepreneurs, can purchase a table and have their information out on that. But you can get that information at the launchfn.com website. There's a link there that says service providers, RSVP here, and you can just get that information there.
And the physical address is 2 Ravenna Drive, Suite 100, Atlanta, Georgia, 30346, which is Wednesday, December 3rd from 5 to 7:30 p.m. And Karen, I really appreciate you coming in and providing that. And everybody else, please understand that Karen will be a part of our social network and our financial piece for the coalition. So this is just not a person that has come on and just given us some information. We're going to have access to Launch for as long as she can sustain dealing with us. So Launch Funding Network is her business. And, Karen, thank you so much. We want to try to continue to follow with you and our site with your information will be up by Friday as well. So I appreciate the patience of your 10-year-old. What did you do to her?
I put her on mute. My Skype was coming up on the other computer, too. Apparently it comes up on both computers, so she was trying to figure out who this person was that was trying to Skype me. So anyway, I was trying to wave. I didn't do my snapping fingers thing. I was just trying to, like, shh, I'm on the phone. Anyway.
Well, I appreciate
you have to be
it.
A multitasker as a mom, you know.
Exactly.
An entrepreneur and a mom, you got to be able to multitask.
Okay, well, thank you, Karen. You
okay, enjoy it. Thank you. Y'all have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thank you for having me on the show. Talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Diane?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so hopefully that will inspire you to continue to move forward. As I said before, we have to be able to identify our resources and see where – typically, I mean, how many people have we talked to when we've launched our businesses and never got the real meat and potatoes of the information that's going to propel you to the next level? Who,
right.
You know, your program is I like to kind of go back over some of the things that we discussed so that we can start the next segment of the show. I'm going to take a break for just a moment. And you guys, everybody online, please hold on for a moment. Give us a minute to take a break, okay?
empty tree that you never want your mother to meet. And finally, I found somebody who fit perfectly. You're everything that I dreamed you'd be. And I'll be what you need, cause I'm playing for keeps, baby.
Ladies, just wanted to also share with you that was Ayana of Elite Entertainment, CEO of one of our young executive programs, and got a little surprise for you, Diane. Talk with Ayana and Marvin, which are the CEOs and CFO of the Elite Entertainment, and they have stated that they will host and provide the vehicle for a Pillow Talk radio.
Oh, wow.
Thank you, guys. So, you know, it's a matter of scheduling and all of that, so we wanted to kind of share that with you. It's important for me to try to convince the young folks, because their direction and their goals and talking with this part of the show, this is our community involvement level that we need to have each show regarding the real crisis and challenges that's in our community. And I wanted to kind of really get into fillintheshoesproduction.com is her website. Real interestingly, this young lady is 26 years old, and your grandmother is one of the pioneers of the city of Atlanta, right?
Correct. Louise Wiley, she is marked with Martin Luther King, and got her letter from Obama saying that she's been doing it for a very long time, and to just thank you for her support. And so, and I guess I come from wisdom a little bit, so I'm able to share that with the young ladies I come across.
Okay, and in talking with you, we talked about what Pillow Talk is with the safe haven, and ladies, please understand that this is so important, that our direction, our charge we have in life is to be a good steward and provide anything that is supposed to be of good nature. And I believe that talking with you earlier, you are right now doing work with a lot of the high school
Hello.
Yeah. Got a lot of breathing on the line here. I don't know who that one is. There you go. Okay, found him. You have to start clicking everybody off. That's somebody's out walking, I guess. But anyway, at any state, the problem that you have been dealing with is that I think we talked about, first of all, just starting from the top, you're the CEO and founder of fillintheshoesproductions.com, and you have two CDs, as we were talking to Karen about, and I guess we understand how to get money from that right away, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, and you work with Spelman College, doing their mentoring on collegiate levels.
I'm about to start that new project in January under Miss Angela Boudreaux, who's over the girls' organization called Worth, and so that's a work in progress right now.
Okay, and I think the young lady that you were talking about, they said Congress came up with a plan to bail out a whole country in one night. Why can't we come up with a plan to save our children?
Well, yeah, what happened was I had an open forum at least 2 weeks ago, called Where's Our Bailout Plan? And in it, the general purpose was, if we can create a plan, if Congress and House leadership team can go into deep thought, planning, and action in one night, to create a plan that would save an entire nation, you know, then it should be very simple to do that for our children. It should be very simple to go in a meeting in a town hall and say, hey, you know, this is what's going to stop in our community. This is what's going to cease and desist with our young ladies. And so, you know, the whole ideal is, you know, where's their bailout plan? Have we forgotten that, you know, they need us? Have we forgotten as parents that they need our guidance and direction? And I think that we need to put those emphasis back in our communities, those villages that raise us, that raise our children, that told our young girls it's not appropriate to listen to certain music, who told our young girls it's important to know your worth and, you know, not let a man tell you everything and to love yourself before anything. And so that was the general gist of the entire forum, and just to, you know, create some awareness, because it's my idea that a lot of parents don't know the things that their daughters confess to me. And so I kind of wanted to put it in the air, you know, when
let's put that in the air right now. One of the things that I think you were talking to a young lady, and you said to me, the young girl asked you, how do I explain to my mother?
Mm-hmm.
That my father is raising me.
Correct.
And so,
that's heartbreaking. That was an 8th grade girl. And so now the crazy part is that they're dealing with things that we didn't ever fathom of dealing with. They're dealing with a new ball game. And so, you know, whereas homes were once safe, you can't even sleep at night in fear that your father's going to force sex on you. And so, you know, when we say, I hear a lot of people say, well, I'm not going to deal with these kids. They're bad. But you got to realize, what are they coming out the house dealing with, bringing it to school? And so how do you expect the child to function and try to succeed in life if she has all of this other stuff going on that she has to go back to at home? And so it's time that we start creating safe environments conducive for our children to become productive adults. You know, it's difficult to ask a child to function on your math when she's worried about, you know, her father forcing sex on her. And so, you know, I think we need to, you know, put those things in the atmosphere, say that they exist, and let's move towards the solution.
And I think I always tell people all the time, but you have a group of women that walks around here that are successful, and I'm not gonna say what the name of that organization is. What is that, League of 100 Black Women, I guess. Oh, I said I wasn't going to say that. But anyway, I think that when a person has achieved a social forum for the community, that I don't care how big you get, you know, you should always reach back into your community. And I think that was I think that was pretty ugly for them to state that basically, even, you know, when you're talking about these are their grandchildren of these,
right,
these women. These are their, you know, nieces and nephews, and they didn't even give you opportunity to even say, look, ma'am, this is what's going on. You know, we have to end sexual exploitation of our young girls. You know, I think that,
right,
Stephanie Davis that you were talking about
right,
has reached out to you, and you guys are doing a project on that level too, right?
Right, right. In my response to that, I heard a sermon one day. I believe it might have been Bishop Eddie Long, but he had a good point. He said, you know, the problem is it's the lights lighting up the light. Instead of lighting up the people that are in darkness, who need prayer, who need somebody to reach out to them and give them words of encouragement, you know, it's the lights lighting up the light. You get to a certain status quo or status in your life, and you feel like the only person I can relate to are people on my level. That's the problem. And so, you know, it's difficult for a young girl to go to a woman that's much older and well-to-do because she feels like she can't relate. And so I feel like my program and I myself is more relatable because not only do I know how to bring it back down to their level, but I'm able to say, well, hey, this is from whence I came. I once was like whatever, and now this is what I'm like. And so it's my charge and my challenge to everybody listening to pass the message on. Don't let a young lady walk past you cussing and being disrespectful if you're out in the mall. Say, hey, you know, you're too attractive to do that, because it's a way to do everything.
Right.
I mean, don't, you know, let the dysfunction continue to perpetuate and you just let it stand as it is.
Yeah, and I think, Michelle, you have a daughter also, right?
Yes, I do.
The challenges that I don't, you know, I'm well away from the ages that the young lady talks to and talks with and offers not just a mentoring, but she pretty much is almost like a big sister that they can confide in. Do you find that that's a challenge for you when your daughter may have had problems and maybe may not have came to you or about?
Well, she's still pretty young yet, where she hasn't really experienced a lot of the challenges that we talked about earlier. But one thing I really enforce is I always tell my daughter to never feel that she can't talk to me, that I want her to feel no matter what it is, she can come to me for anything. And I think it's really important as mothers that we instill that in our children, whether we have boys or girls, to create an environment where they can come, you know, come to you and discuss things no matter what the situation is. Sometimes at school she'll have a problem with somebody in her class or someone in a program she's in, and there have been a couple times she will come to me maybe several days later. And I've learned that sometimes kids are apprehensive to open up to certain situations right away. And so for me, I think the only challenge is really getting my daughter to tell me in a timely fashion that this is what's going on, this is what's happening. So yeah, I think as time progresses, I really have to really continue to ask those questions and really continue to create an environment where she feels not only safe but comfortable to tell me what's going on, no matter how big or small it is.
But we're so displaced from the level that Diana was talking about, because I think another young girl has approached you. You've had so many stories of young people who have come to you and confided in you, right, Diane, on just some of the challenges.
Oh, definitely.
You
I mean, it's things that we wouldn't even, you know, begin to think about. I mean, even if it's something minute as, you know, what if I like somebody? How do I approach? I mean, these young girls are asking some of, you know, questions from a broad span, but also, you know, just the simple things that, you know, they don't know. And that, like I said during my open forum, mothers and parents and guardians, period, are spending too much time in other places, and their child is looking for love. I mean, and that's the bigger picture. I mean, we're spend our money at happy hour on a Friday and send our children to school looking like work. I mean, when I go to these schools, these young girls, hair on stuff, sticking on top of their head, anything, on shorts in the fall. I mean, you know, where are you when your child walk out the door in the morning? And so, you know, we need to get back, put our priorities back in line. It's time out for all the fun and, you know, all the Friday night hanging out. I mean, let's put it back in the home. Let's give that nurturing back into our home.
Let's talk about pillow talk. Let's talk about that while we have some time left on it. Talk to us about what your vision is in terms of the play. Talk about the being able to orchestrate that as a way to launch awareness inside the communities throughout the United States, because we're going to have folks who are listening in from all over. And, of course, you know, this is recorded right after the show becomes archived. Tell us about Pillow Talk and what your vision is so that we can help you further along with that.
Oh, definitely. When I thought about the idea, you know, you have a lot of people that think about girl talk. Well, I mean, these girls are not dealing with girl issues anymore. They're dealing with women issues. And so an adult thought of Pillow Talk is intimate conversation or dialogue between a man and a woman to sum up their day, to talk about, you know, issues that may be going on in their relationship. And so I wanted to, you know, just, you know, get a program together that would, you know, hone in on those things, adult-like things. I mean, because these girls are doing adult-like things. And so where I go around the city of Atlanta with Pillow Talk, and we get naked. I mean, we get naked. And I'm using that word as precisely as I can, because we don't cover up things as if they don't exist. If it's lesbianism that we're dealing with, then that's what we're dealing with. If it's rape that we're dealing with, then that's what I'm dealing with, because they are prevalent in our community, whether people know it or not. But right now, it's only local. Mm-hmm.
Or they accept it. They won't accept it. They won't accept that
right.
Their husband is, or their boyfriend is doing things to them. They refuse to. They'll do anything to maintain that. And you are breaking those barriers for them to have a place to go.
Definitely. And I'm just trying, it's my goal and my vision to expand it. I was telling you earlier that, you know, I know this is my passion, because you know, when you start, I had to cut my hours on my job in order to see my vision through, because I understand that if you stay faithful over those small things, then God will bless you with those bigger things. And so I understand that our young women need this. I understand that if I had half of what I've given back to these young women when I was growing up, you know, it'll make my journey easier. And so, you know, I want to be able to travel all over the state and just create some awareness to let these girls know that there are people who care, because they tell me, I'm like, no one cares, Ms. Diana. And I tell them, you know, that's not true. And so Georgia is not enough for me. You know, yeah. North Carolina, South Carolina, I'm sure there are other organizations doing the same thing. Let's collaborate. Let's stop thinking about, hey, I don't want her to come up quicker than I am. Let's do a collaborative effort to change and make a universal difference in the lives of our young women.
Well, I think the only other part is I really want to touch bases with this this sexual exploitation. And a lot of these girls do not understand that if you were in a position, it's economics. The reason why our coalition exists is that we provide a hope of economic level. It's not just them coming to us and telling about their problems, but our programs are now being positioned to launch in 2009 in January to be able to produce income of different scenarios for programs for the for just all of our participants inside all the different levels of what we're working with. And so the conscious thing is being able to the mentoring level that you're doing on the collegiate level is a tremendous thing. But we also need to come back to an economic level. A lot of these girls probably act like this because the homes are, you know, the mothers are not working, or, you know, they have different challenges. And you know, the economy is bad, and so people become more, I don't know the word for it. They forget where they come from. They don't understand that we as women of color, you know, we've been through everything. It's pretty much nothing else you can do to us. I think you were talking to me about this pillow talk, and I want to just really reiterate that our support level has to be on community as well as business. And so the women that are that will call in, or the ones that are going to archive this show and listen to this show, we need to be able to support our girls, not just by mentoring, but doing internships and providing guidance and a level of economics opposed to anything else. So I wanted to kind of bring that point up. But the pillow talk thing, what I was thinking is that if we can do the show, Ayana will host the show, and we can actually, you know, all the kids that you talk to when they get back in school, you know, I think Ayana has made a strong name and presence for herself here in Atlanta, or just actually in Georgia. You know, she's a platinum label artist, but she's up in New York right now, and they told us about a story last week that a young girl ran away from home, and the reason why she ran away from home is because her stepfather was raping her. And so Ayana ran her down, found her, and the girl was able to open up to her, just to her, because Ayana looks like her, talks like her, understands the problems for her. So we need to resurrect more women, young women like yourself, to be able to have a platform, because you're doing a lot on your own, but we need to support you, not just in that way, but not turn our backs on you because we feel that, you know, we're making XYZ amount of money a year, so I'll just donate it to the, you know, the Negro Fund and be done with it. I think we have to change the face of everything that we're doing. On our website, it says we're changing the face of contracting, but in the same part, it also says a charge I have to keep, and I keep reverting back to that because your charge in life, and you understand your desire, and I have to commend you on that. You have to stay strong, and like I was telling you, that no matter what you do, as you know, in your walk, I think my mom is on the phone, Ms. Freeman, and she's always told us that, you know, prayer always changes things, but you have to put, you know, faith. And you have to have faith and then put action toward that. So I just wanted to kind of stress that. And I just want to make sure that we are very cognizant on the level of what we're trying to do in this show and inspiring success. And people say, well, you know, what does that have to do with contracting? It has nothing to do with contracting. If a foundation is poured incorrectly, okay, with too much water, and
definitely, I think I'm about to lose you all. My phone is about to go dead, and I just want to, if I can, just, you know, thank you for the invitation. I'm even speaking with you today, and I think what you're doing is very beautiful, and, you know, anything I can do to support you, just let me know I'm there, and, you know, it, for all the listeners, for all the parents and mothers, and let's stop talking about it and put it to action, and, you know, feel free to visit my website at www.feelingissuesproductions.com.
Okay.
Or they may call me toll-free if young girls need some assistance or need to talk about anything. I'm always there and toll-free, 866-787-5642. I think I'm about to die. If I could get back in on the landline, I'll call you back shortly.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
You guys, I think the callers that we still have on, Michelle, Denora, Ms. Freeman, and the caller from 763 area code, I think that we should have an open discussion for the next few minutes about, in theory, these young girls. I mean, it has to take a little toll on you to listen to the stories of what this young lady had to say. And actually, her just putting her career aside to move this mission. What do you think about that, Ms. Freeman? When you're doing a lot of charitable work at the church, and you have people that come through the lines, are they young women that go through there too?
No, we do not have any really young women coming through our lines. They are older women and men, but I can relate to what she's saying. She has put her career on hold so she can reach out to the young women, and you can't find that too many places today, because everyone wants to get what they want, and that's it. They are not thinking about reaching back and helping someone else.
I think too, another big challenge, if I could chime in, is that a lot of people, especially parents, are under so much pressure to making sure that their kids, you know, the lunches are paid for, all those things. And I think the economic situation has played a huge part in a lot of the turmoil that's going on with a lot of the young girls, meaning that you have a lot of single parent homes, a lot of them just have a mom, and a lot of these mothers are dealing with 3 and 4 children of various ages, and they're under so much pressure to make sure they're making enough money to make ends meet and, you know, have the resources they need just to take care of the basics, to the point that I really don't think that a lot of moms don't care, or not just moms, just women in general, but the biggest challenge, and I can speak to that personally, is really trying to find the balance of making ends meet and also putting in that quality time. I mean, when a woman is working from 6 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning till maybe late at night, 5, 6, 7 o'clock, I mean, I hear a lot of women putting in ridiculous work hours because they're really under so much pressure, and they're tired by the time they get home and stuff. And, you know, there's some moms that put in the time, you know, to read to the kids and so forth and so on. But I guess what I'm really trying to get at is I think this is one of the biggest problems a lot of people are dealing with. And a lot of times the kids, the young people, they see that their mothers or, you know, whoever they're with are tired or under the gun, so they're apprehensive to open up. So I really think there's got to be a way where, I guess what I'm trying to say is we have to find that balance so there is that opportunity in that environment to feel like these young people can open up, you know, have trust to open up to their loved ones or another woman who may have been in the same position. But yeah, I think that's a big challenge.
Well, I can honestly say this much. If you beat your child like my mama used to beat us, you would only do so much at a time, you know. I only can be, I mean, I'm saying that really seriously. Hopefully DFAX is listening. But any Child Protective Services, I just think that the hand of the young parents today, you know, when we were growing up, if she said, don't do this, don't sit on my furniture, we got furniture in our house that nobody ever sat on in the living room for 20 years, you know. And when we finally got to sit on, we were grown, and we were scared at that time. But my point of it is, jokingly enough, we have to, you know, I think the methods of how we were raised are different. You can't really beat your children. You know, my mother should be going into consecutive life sentences, you know, based on the beatings that we took. But we're still here, and I earned them. I gave her a run for her money, so I can say that much. But she won, so even right now, you have to have a respect and fear of your mother. That's how we were raised, you know, and that's different now. I guess you have younger mothers to, you know, I don't even think it's younger, because it was women having babies back when my grandmother was older. When she was alive, she told me she was married when she was 12. So I think it's just like you said, Michelle, it's the economy and how we, you know, the strain that a single mom has to have put on them. You know, I certainly believe that in any form that you have to direct everything back to faith and God, and how you, not just how you were brought up, but how you are, how you stay up. You know, people say, well, you know, that's not how I was brought up. Well, how have you stayed up to this point? How have you been able to sustain yourself all these years? Because it's not about your childhood, it's about your adulthood. So we have to kind of, you know, I understand that mothers are working and all that, and there's no short turn to that at all. We have such a large challenge ahead of us, you know, in terms of us as women of color, single moms, you know, mothers, aunts. I think we just have to take our community back the same way we took the, you know, took presidency. You know, we have to do it just, yes, we can. We can't do it one step at a time. We're really in a crisis on every level. Our social commitment on in our communities are, you know, and distressed. And when this young lady told me that this prestigious organization stated that they couldn't even talk to her because you had to be a member and be involved in the organization for her to even come to them about a program. I hope we never grow to that level. Whoever chairs the local, regional levels of the coalition, that they never turn their nose up and say, no, you know, no, we can't. You know, one thing that Diana said was that people are going to live in the moment. So I think that that's where we are right now. We're about 2 minutes into our show ending, and I certainly appreciate everybody tuning in and chiming in. And I just want to thank everybody this Thanksgiving for just being very supportive and understanding about the challenges that we have and the goals that we've set. They are very tremendous, but I think we just have to stay functional, and I appreciate everybody, and happy Thanksgiving, and God bless everybody, and please be safe, and I want to thank everybody and thank God for this time again to be able to present this type of show. Thank you, callers, and we should be coming off the air in the next 30 or 45 seconds. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
I'm playing for keeps, baby, yeah.
up heaven for one day with you.
I gotta stop and breathe. Let it out slowly, please. If it's a dream, don't pinch me, baby. Could you let me sleep? As long as I see your face.